Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know our drill. Yes, we are recording on Wednesday morning. So I'm going to start banging the drum about Project 2025. I warned you yesterday, we'll get ready, because we're now up to installment number two. We are taking Ann Nelson's fabulous piece at the Washington Spectator, and we are literally giving you chunks of it almost every single day, including long-term and in-depth interviews with her every week. The title of her piece was Project 2025, The Latest Plot Against America. We're now into installment two. And as she writes, Project 2025 is actually in the opening salvo of the 2025 presidential transition project. The comprehensive 900-page playbook was produced under the auspices of the Heritage Foundation and supported by over 100 partner organizations. It's officially entitled Mandate for Leadership, The Conservative Promise. Project 2025 lays out specifics for hundreds of policy objectives affecting every area of public life. Many of them affect three primary political rights for women and LGBTQ populations and the elimination of public health measures. And the third is a massive purge of career civil servants and the concentration of power in the executive branch in the White House to consolidate an entrenched authoritarian regime. That describes Project 2025. Tomorrow, we begin to look at just 10 of the most alarming features of Project 2025. What is my point? Ignore Project 2025 at your peril, as Ann Nelson says. They are telling us your job is to listen, learn, and act. So I'm now discovered the Washington Spectator. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I think it's a great thing, but I apologize for not being aware of it. And after interviewing Ann Nelson and asking her to join me, the editor of the Washington Spectator said, you know, you might want to interview these two guys. And I'm like, okay, so send me the information. And he sent me the first part of a series, a two-part series entitled Dancing in the Dark, Steps to Avoid a Constitutional Coup in the 2024 election. I was looking at a comment under this article at the Washington Spectator, and I thought I would start with the comment and then I will introduce my two guests. While most of us are by now aware of potential threats to the next presidential election in the form of disputes about mail-in voting, vote counting apparatus, and potentially violent election interference, Messrs. Mettisch and McCleary focus on arcane legislative procedures that could be potentially much more concerning and much more difficult to remedy. Only someone with an intimate knowledge of House rules and procedures could have produced this valuable analysis. Joining us are the two individuals that helped produce this valuable analysis. We have joining us Mr. McCleary. He is a political and governmental strategist with 40 years of international and domestic experience. He was a White House Deputy Assistant for Political Affairs to President Carter. He previously served as Treasurer of the Democratic National Committee. He was President of Sawyer Miller, an international and leading international political and media consulting firm of its time. The firm ran presidential and prime minister campaigns in over 15 countries. And I could go on and on and on, but let me welcome you to the program. Thank you so much for doing this. We also have joining us the co-writer of this piece, Mark Mettisch. He, too, has offered 30 years of professional experience in policy, law, finance, development, and strategic communications. He served as in the White House as a special assistant to the president and senior director on the National Security Council and on the U.S. Treasury as deputy assistant secretary for international affairs. He's worked in senior positions at the State Department and the United Nations. He is vice president of a Project Associates Limited, a London-headquartered strategic consultancy firm in Europe and the Middle East. I could go on and on and on. And he is the co-founder of Keep Our Republic, a nonprofit civic education organization promoting democratic governance and rule of law. So, Mr. Mettisch, thank you for joining us as well. And I think in some ways, Keep Our Republic is the inspiration for the two of you writing this piece. So I am very, very grateful. And I guess I'm going to start by saying, you know, which one should I turn to first? The two of you know each other. Mark, is he the one to go? All right, so Mark, open us up about this piece, because I have been focusing on election and on election turnout and about the integrity of the vote and the ability to undermine what we see as what Donald Trump has been successful at, which is the big lie. But this piece, Dancing in the Dark at the Washington Spectator, took me to a place I am not familiar with and I never would have gone to but for you. So explain to us what this first piece is about and why you have concerns not about the election per se, but the time between the election and the actual inauguration of the presidency. We know that it is, you know, after January 6th, we know that there may be problems with it. I just did not know the extent and the potential here for the kind of damage that could be done. So let me welcome you to the program.
Arnie, thanks so much for having us on, and thank you for what you're doing to keep our republic. And thanks to all your listeners for their interest. Dancing in the Dark, we can't blame it on Bruce Springsteen. It's a good song, but our piece is a little different. What Joel and I tried to do was look at what we call unconventional threats to the election system. And we think this is important because of everything we've learned since January 6th, and indeed before that, you go back to Lafayette Square, that there are clearly elements in America willing to use really extraordinary methods to gain power. And we take that very seriously. So what we did is, in the first piece, look at what could go wrong in the House of Representatives in the election period and the transition period, based on precedents, not theory, but things that have happened before in terms of congressional parliamentary procedure in the House. It's really possible to manipulate the incoming majority after an election by challenging House seats. Then in the case of what's called a contingent election, if the Electoral College is unable to make a decision about the president, the election could go into the House of Representatives under the 12th Amendment. So, and whoever is Speaker and whoever is the majority has an enormous impact on how that will play out.
And I want you to go through in detail what the potential is for all the sort of pitfalls and undermining of what ultimately could be the will of the people. But Joel, I'm kind of curious because I'm grateful that you have spent all this time in incredible detail looking at from the time of an election to the time of inaugural about what it is that we need to be concerned about. And I want you guys to share it. But I have a question, and I don't know whether you have the answer. So we've been learning a lot about this huge tome, Project 2025, these 900 pages, incredibly thick, incredibly detailed, very, very bureaucratic. Is what you have discussed in your article, Joel, in the Washington Spectator, about how they can sort of game the system, how they can sort of address the certification process, all the things that you talk about, has that also been discussed in Project 2025? Or did they not drill down in that aspect of what could happen between the election and the inauguration? And are you in some ways a point of sort of, you know, of information that that wasn't included in that huge document, but now we need to add this to all the other potential things that could happen? I'm just wondering if there's parallels or if they didn't even get into that. And that should make me even more afraid because it could have been a 1,000-page tome.
You know, Mark and I, since we've done a lot of international work, we always say that two parts to coming to power. First, you have to win an election, or it has to be assumed that or constitutionally accepted that you've won the election. And the other is that you have to take, that's where the coup d'etat happens, is when you take over the government. Very few people in history are ready for the taking over the government. And Trump's analysis of what happened to him and why he's being, having all these trials and why he didn't achieve what he wanted to achieve, he was not ready to take power. He was not ready to take over the bureaucracy. And he realized that that was the failure of his first administration. So now he has assembled a team that understand that they're really going to go for it, that the real thing is to, yes, take the oath on January 20th, but the next one is to move quickly to take over the entire government and make it an instrument of the policies that they want to pursue. In my view, what you're seeing is just the tip of the iceberg, and they are really putting together, not only people to go in and take over positions, but also a very complicated, very complex means of taking absolute power. We'd like to say that a president has two, once you get power, a president has two powers, two existential powers. One, he can blow up the world, theoretically, with a push of the of his finger on the button, right? And the second is that with a stroke of the pen, Given the immense emergency powers that are at the disposal of a president, he can end a democracy. So we just say, listen to what they're saying, not just over at Heritage, but in many different places. Take them seriously. They have a mission. Just listen and understand what its implications are.
Okay, so let me turn to you, Mark, and that is that I'm gonna pull from your piece. You write, no electoral system is perfect. In parliamentary democracies, if an election fails to produce a winner or winning coalition, a caretaker government is left in place, and fresh elections are held to determine a new government according to a timeline. The US, however, has particularly weak or problematic provisions for failed or indeterminate elections for federal office. Foremost among these are, oh my God, the presidency. Unlike the Senate and House, there is no provision for a president election do-over. So now what I'm hearing from Joel is what happens once he's established himself as the president. What your piece, however, is about is making sure he gets himself established as the president, because we think that, you know, that we get closure on election day. And what your article is all about is, A, honey bun, think outside the box. There is no closure on election day. And here are the months and opportunities and provisions that could, in fact, not only prove that there is no closure, but actually strip voters' rights away from them and set up either, you know, Donald Trump as president or some other variation on the theme where we basically don't even know who's president, not just for a couple of weeks, but possibly for four years. So explain to me what's going on, Mark, because I think we need to understand about this time frame that nobody has actually ever paid attention to.
I think you're asking the key question, Arnie, because it really goes to January 6th in the popular imagination and understanding. I mean, we all watched what was going on. The visual is so powerful. It was an insurrection, rebellion, a mob, a riot. But there was another dimension to it, almost more sinister than those criminal activities. And that is, it was actually a deliberate attempt to pull off a coup against the Constitution, because the goal was to prevent the vice president from fulfilling the unique duty that he had to preside over the certification of the Electoral College result. And if Mike Pence had been prevented from doing that, it basically would have opened Pandora's box. We would have been in uncharted territory, a contingent election in the House, potential chaos. That really was the goal at that point. And we see this in all of the what the January 6th committee learned, what Jack Smith has learned through his subsequent investigations.
We point to the fact that if Speaker Johnson had been Speaker in 2020, we might have had a very different result. And I think you need to explain to people why the Speaker is so pivotal in this conversation, because when you understand the history of Johnson before he became Speaker, you were absolutely right, because he wanted to make sure that he could orchestrate what ultimately was this lethal attempt to undermine the results of the election. And I think people need to understand the man before he became Speaker, and why, if he were in the position of Speaker, that position is an incredibly powerful one, no matter what we assume could happen with a vice president or something else, because he controls the rules of the House and the House.
That's exactly right. It's really important to understand that under our Constitution, the two houses of Congress are sovereign in their own bodies with respect to their internal rules. So whoever's in the majority in respective house can really drive things through. It's not something governed by law. You can't just appeal to the courts to come in and fix or prevent a power play. And really, what Joel and I have done is to illustrate, based on historical precedent in both houses, the House of Representatives and the Senate, how power plays can work, how a majority and a speaker or a leader of a majority can ram things through and cram things down in terms of manipulation of the rules. And a problem in an election situation is we're up against a really tight timeline. No, because the Constitution says such and such has to happen on January 3rd. Something has to happen on January 6th. Inauguration has to happen on January 20th. There's an inflexibility there that is great if you want certainty, but if you're a malign actor, if you want to disrupt the process, you can create a constitutional crisis.
Joel, I'm looking at your piece and you give me too many opportunities to be frightened. One is the ability to hijack the House, and you have two sections, gaming the House certification process, gaming the state certification process. I mean, every time I turn around, there's another bite at this apple. And then you have a section called short-circuiting the Electoral College, and then filibustering the presidential inauguration. I mean, there are like so many ways to slice this apple, Joel. So I guess my biggest fear is that I talk a lot about Speaker Johnson, and I'm frightened about the House. And we saw how long it took them to actually initially elect a speaker. He didn't last very long. Then they pulled someone they thought was a backbencher named Mike Johnson, and now he is the Speaker of the House. And then when you understand his history, you get even more terrified. And I'm going to say something, Joel. I'm not as worried about the Senate as I am about the House. The House seems to be the most dysfunctional and yet the most powerful when it comes to what is going to happen vis-a-vis this choice of president. And that's where the most of the damage could happen. And that's where the rules could be so manipulated that we don't get anything that reflects a result of the will of the people, but basically reflects the will of the people that are basically hijacking the situation, because it seems to be easy to hijack, Joel, the House of Representatives.
It's easy. We call it helter skelter. The strategy that we're dealing with is a very complex state, local, federal strategy. And that is to work on the weaknesses of the system, to screw it up as many ways as you possibly can. First, to make sure that if you don't win the popular vote, or if it seems questionable, that it goes to the House for a decision where it's almost assured that the Republicans would win or that Trump would win. So there are many different ways to get there. And we're dealing with this very strong bipartisan group, former Republican governors and judges and Democrats who want to make sure that this system at least has the people understand that the system does work, the electoral system does work. And that these attempts to try to short circuit it or to short circuit the certification processes all the way along is an attempt to stage a coup in reality. You have to understand that. The House is one part of it, the Senate is one part of it, what you do right when you take power is a part of it. So voters need to understand the whole process that we're getting involved with. As Mark likes to say, this is not like the old times where you went and you did your vote. And you went home and you went to see what happened, and you just assumed that the ship of state was not going to go off course. This is a coup d'etat. It's being stated. This is not some mystery. And that's why when you read what Herridge is saying, when the presidential candidate basically doesn't support the Constitution, when a presidential candidate basically says that the only result that he is going to accept is his victory, we're into a situation that we've never been in before. And
And
it's
you can't just hear the
always
words of Donald Trump, though. So, Joel, you just—I mean, again, it is mirrored, it is echoed with everyone else within the MAGA movement. So, we keep thinking, listen to what Donald Trump is saying. No. Listen to what they're all saying, because
correct.
in the end, he doesn't accomplish it in isolation. He
Correct.
accomplishes it because he has a moat around him that wants to basically get there. Because people are thinking, well, it'll be okay. The Democrats have a really good chance of taking over the House. Except, guess what? Speaker Johnson will still be the speaker during that period of time between the election and the change in leadership in the House. He will still, am I correct here? When does Speaker Johnson step aside?
Once the majority is determined of the new House, and the problem is there's this whole transition period where House seats are being confirmed and
Challenged.
solidified, and that's being done by the old House, and
Yes.
so he's the leader. So yeah, there's room for mischief there. The great thing about our country is that for decades and generations, centuries, no one has tried to mess with that, but we are confronting a new reality today. And that's what we need to be alert to. So part of it is public consciousness and public awareness. You want to put the spotlights, the Klieg lights, on these plans and conspiracies that are in the offing. They talk about it openly. We didn't. That's the other thing. Joel and I simply listened to what folks were saying among the extremists. We're not giving them ideas. They're already talking about these things, and we have the quotes in our articles.
You end your piece by what can be done. And of course, what makes me physically nauseous is your first line of defense is the courts. And I'm like, yeah, I know I saw what they did initially, but I'm looking at the Supremes. I'm looking at the toxic environment and the lack of trust, frankly, in the courts. And frankly, look at what a lot of the MAGA governors are doing. They're ignoring the courts. I mean, so we look at the courts as this line of defense. And I guess, Joel, I'm going to ask you, but if there's no respect for the decision making of the courts, how can they even be a first line of defense? I mean, let me introduce you to Governor Abbott. He's, you know, proof positive, you know, the court can come down with a decision and he can bring, you know, 12 or 13 Republican governors down to Texas and they all flip the bird at the courts. So as much as I would like to think that they are a line of defense, who's going to respect their decisions?
When Trump first came to office, one of his advisors told me that they put a picture of Andrew Jackson up on the wall in the Oval Office and he didn't really understand why. And the reason they put that picture up was Andrew Jackson had this famous, whether it's true or not, it's always quoted, that when the courts tried to help the Cherokee Indians, Andrew Jackson wasn't very interested in that. He didn't like the decision. And theoretically, he said, well, if the court has an army, let them enforce it. But he went down in his own direction. The court only works if you acknowledge it.
Exactly.
When you start dealing with coup d'etats, when you talk about taking total power, you're in just a very different paradigm. And people need to wake up to what is theoretically possible and listen to what they're saying. And this is what the MAGA people, MAGA people are talking about, a real revolution from A to Z.
First of all, we should all acknowledge that the courts did a terrific job. In
yes, they did.
Yeah, they did.
I capisce.
So yeah, but we hear you. They're relying on the legal system alone, not enough, because we're in a political situation here. But we do have other, we have checks and balances, and that's why the Senate piece is actually quite important, because I think Joel and I are as frustrated as so many people with the gridlock in the Senate due to the filibuster. Basically, you need not a simple majority, 60. But a 60-vote majority in the Senate to do any business. And that's very frustrating. People are calling for reform. But actually, in this context that we're in, the filibuster could be an important guardrail. I'd rather have gridlock than authoritarianism. And if the price is a Senate that requires a supermajority to do business, maybe that's not a bad thing. For now, in this situation.
Oh my God.
That's what our second piece is about.
All right, well, then I will grab you for your second piece. Trust me, you can explain that in detail. But then you let me give my audience your second line of defense and your third line. Your second line of defense, parliamentary gymnastics, oy vey, and state level deterrence. And your third line of defense, the marathon work of rallying bipartisan voices and building a citizen's firewall for democracy. So Joel, I'm going to start with the third, not the second. And that is that's where I get to play, okay? I'm in that marathon work of rallying bipartisan voices. I've always said part of what you have to understand about democracy is that in a lot of ways, it is a lot like gymnastics in some ways. When you first start, you haven't developed the muscle. But the more and more you do, the more your muscles become more and become stronger and more nimble and more creative. We have let our muscle atrophy when it comes to democracy. And that's what scares me so much, Joel. And what you're asking us to do now, thinking as they're working in ways that are so outside the box, how do we move people and move them as quickly as they need to move to understand what's at stake?
They're very good people on both sides and in both parties. I'll give you an example. Chip Roy from Texas is considered to be a very, very radical right winger. But on principle, he voted to certify Biden.
Yeah.
He was a man of principle. And the fact is that right all the way through right to left, there are people who believe in the Constitution and who do not want to short circuit it and do not want to short circuit the system. And that's why this Ukrainian vote is very important. There are people on both sides of the party, you know, in both parties that feel that vote should go to the floor and we should know where we're going.
And I need to let you go. I need to let you go. I will get you back, I promise. And you write at the very end, we must not let failure of imagination impede our preparedness. Constitutional hardball must not be allowed to devolve into just plain hardball, or we will lose our republic. In truth, we are already in this fight. A fabulous piece at the Washington Spectator. I encourage everyone to read it. I'll post it on my Facebook page, Dancing in the Dark, Steps to Avoid a Constitutional Coup in the 2024 Election. We've been talking with its two authors, Mark Medish and Joel McCleary. Thank you, gentlemen, very much for doing this, and I hope to invite you back. This, everyone, is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around. We'll be right back.
It's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history, when your parents lived through things that looked so much like this, all the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place, and you once again see the rising of the master race, when you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance, when you know for many people this will be their last chance, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth, when you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth, when they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before, when Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news, when the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity, when you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells, when you see approaching the future this foretells, when they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away, when you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Continue to record on Wednesday morning. It's a sobering conversations we're having today. We love having Amy Littlefield on. She is the nation's abortion access correspondent and a journalist who focuses on reproductive rights, healthcare, and religion. And I'm smiling, Amy, because I don't know if you know this, but I was on my way to divinity school, okay? I was pre-sem. I was a religion major when I went to St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. I decided at the last minute that I wasn't going to go to divinity school. I ended up at law school. And guess what I did when I was at law school? I worked for an abortion clinic in Rutland, Vermont.
Of course you did.
So as I'm reading what you cover, I feel like that describes my life, you know, the intersection between reproductive rights and religion. And why did I run for the New Hampshire legislature? Because I had my first baby born without health insurance. Because although I worked 50 hours a week, I was working three part-time jobs, and none of those part-time jobs could provide me with access to health insurance. And I decided I wasn't going to get mad, I was going to get even. And I ran for the legislature so I could find a way to provide access to health care for part-time workers. So in a lot of ways, what you write about is what I've lived my life. So that's why I think I totally adore you.
Oh, but my God.
I know, it's just so funny. And nobody knows this about me. You know, everybody, it's just so ironic. But it's a way for me to at least share a little bit about me, but why who you are and what you write about really speaks to my head and my heart. So thank you.
I love
so
you,
much.
Arnie. Every time I come on, you have a new story that surprises me about some fascinating aspect of your life.
Well, I adore you. So I as soon as I saw it happen in Florida, I realized I needed to reach out to you. Because if anybody understands this fight, understands its potential, understands the sacrifice that will happen on the way to this fight, it is Amy Littlefield. And I pulled out a couple of stories and I'm going to share them with my audience. And then I'm going to let you comment in any way, shape, or form. The first one was from one of my absolute favorite writers at Slate.com, Mark Joseph Stern, who has just taught me so much and has been so generous with his time on my little radio station. I see him on MSNBC and I'm going, oh my God, and he does Arnie too. And his piece was, "The Giant Threat Lurking Behind Florida's November Abortion Vote." A very, very important and powerful piece. And then this one from Axios, "Democrats Dream of Turning Florida Blue with Abortion Rights Gets a Boost." And then the other two, "The Florida Abortion Ban Could Sway the Election, How Abortion and Pot Could Reshape the November Election." But more importantly, "Florida Abortion Providers Brace for 6 Weeks Ban." Where are these 80,000 patients going to go? In a separate decision, the state Supreme Court also allowed voters to decide on enshrining rights in the Constitution. And I guess I almost want to start at the last one, not the first one. "Florida abortion providers brace for a 6 weeks ban. Where are these 80,000 patients going to go?" And I think people don't realize how many of people have turned to Florida as a place to get a legal abortion. And they don't think that way. But because they are now sort of this sort of like isolated state, they in for perhaps Virginia, where people in the South can go for a safe and accessible abortion, Florida is one of those places, despite the fact they had a 15-week ban, I believe. But tell me a little bit about what's going on before this decision and why we need to really focus on what could potentially happen in November. Explain the sort of the position of Florida right now, and 80,000 abortions and patients are going there. That's not mifepristone. That's about an abortion.
Arnie, I'm so glad that you started with this question, which is where the focus belongs, which is on the human suffering that is going to result from this decision, right? So many people are starting with the politics, starting with November, starting with Joe Biden and what this means for Democrats. And that's important. And I know we'll talk about that and we'll get to that. But I'm so glad that you started with this question about what this means right now today for people in the South who are finding out they're pregnant and don't know what to do. And so I want to start with just directly addressing people who are pregnant in the South, who are making decisions or who might already have an abortion appointment. Nothing has changed as of right now today. And I say that because the confusion and the fear is part of the strategy here. And there's a lot of times when there's headlines that say 6 week ban, then people assume it's already in effect. And so if you have an abortion appointment in Florida, nothing has changed as of right now. The 6 week ban will go into effect May 1st. It is not in effect yet. The state of Florida already had a 15-week ban, which had taken effect before, and that is still in effect. If you're confused and you need help or you need to find help from a friend, you can go to ineedana.com. And I know, Arnie, you have listeners all over the country. ineedana.com will help you figure out what your options are no matter what state you live in. So just want to say that right off the bat. I mean, we have talked before, Arnie, about how the South is a funnel, right? With a solid block of more than a dozen states that have been sending patients into Florida. More than 7,000 patients traveled to Florida for abortions last year, even with that 15-week ban that already in place, from Texas, Mississippi. Georgia has a 6-week ban already. And also international travelers coming from places in Central America and the Caribbean were making their way to Florida. 84,000 patients in a year in Florida. There is no state anywhere that can come close to absorbing that patient load. And this Florida was one of only three states that didn't have a 6 week ban in the entirety of the Southeast, the campaign manager for the ballot initiative told me. And so, you know, the other part of this that I want to really underscore, Andrea Mercado, who I talked to with Florida Rising, one of the groups that's working for this abortion rights ballot initiative, told me more Black women live in the South than anywhere else in the country, more Latina women in the South than any other part of the country. So we cannot lose sight of who this is going to impact. And the devastating, you know, results of the 6 week ban when it takes effect May 1st on people's hopes, dreams, lives, and futures.
That needs to be in a PSA. That needs to be on a billboard. That needs that there are more Black women in the South than anywhere else in the country. There are more Latino women in the South than anywhere in the country. That Florida absorbed 84,000 abortions. And when it comes down to the 6 weeks, where are they going to go? What does that mean? Not just for Floridians, but for almost everyone, every woman in the South, every family in the South. This is not just a woman's issue. It's a family issue. It's a healthcare issue. I mean, people, but in so many ways, what you just described to me, Amy, numbers matter. Numbers tell a story because numbers say it could be you. It could be you. And unless we understand, and I want to speak to Latino women and I want to speak to Black women and say, look at what? The target is on your back. They literally have a target on your back. And where are you going to go? Understand that you have power. That power is in the vote. But until now and then, look at how compromised your health is. It is just shocking, Amy.
And Arnie, there's one piece that I want to add to this that's really important. I mean, you're absolutely right. But there are, as there have always been in the landscape of abortion access, there are staggering contradictions that we need to wrap our heads around here, right? So it is simultaneously true that you have 84,000 people who got abortions in Florida last year, more than in almost any other state in the country, right? And that those patients now are going to have to find somewhere else to go. And it is also true that because of shield laws that have been passed in blue states like New York and Massachusetts, there are clinicians in those states who are providing medication abortion by mail to patients in Florida, in Texas, in states where abortion is banned. And so you can go to plancpills.org to find out more about those options, which are coming from groups like Aid Access that used to be shipping from abroad. Now they're shipping domestically because of these shield laws. In some ways, it has never been logistically easier to get a medication abortion in this country, even if you live in a state where abortion is heavily restricted or banned. But there are legal questions surrounding that. And so it's good to educate yourself and inform yourself if you're going to, move forward with an option like that. If when how is a legal organization that can provide help with that. But I'm going to have a piece in The Nation soon. I've been spending time with these clinicians who sit in their home offices in New York and fill out a prescription and send it off to Texas or Florida, and it takes 90 seconds. Okay. So we have these, as there always has been, these staggering realities. And so that's why I wanted to put the information out there. Things have not changed. There are options. There are resources. You can find them at places like ineedana.com and plancpills.org, because often the confusion and the lack of information is as limiting as what the courts happen to be doing on a given day, right?
So let me remind everyone again, you say confusion is part of their asset. I mean, that's what they want. They want you to be confused. They don't want you to have accurate information because accuracy means that you are empowered and you can make decisions about your life. But part of that confusion is that the mifepristone case is before the Supreme Court. So remind my audience what that means too, because again, they've heard all that. Again, it has not been decided and all these challenges. And frankly, I'm not sure the court will decide to, in fact, support what is being suggested with this mifepristone case, not because they're not suddenly like they're enlightened. It's because they're not quite sure about the standing issue. They're not quite sure of what the rest of the pharmaceutical companies are saying about the FDA's decision making. But remind my audience a little bit about the mifepristone case, because again, they know about that, but it has not been decided. And the likelihood is it will not be decided in favor of the folks that want to ban it.
Right. I mean, the mifepristone case comes from the fact that the anti-abortion movement has caught on to the fact that they can't actually stop abortion. I mean,
Right.
hello, right? As long as there are the male exists, right? And as and by the way, even if, I don't want to get too ahead of myself, but even if the Supreme Court, buys these anti-abortion arguments, there are community support networks like Las Libres, like Red State Access. There are organizations that are peer-to-peer, friend-to-friend, putting pills in people's hands, in ways that the court is not going to be able to touch, right? But in terms of these clinician options that I mentioned, right, the shield laws, the people in blue states who are shipping to red states, who are clinicians who are doing so, under the letter of laws in their blue states, that could be impacted by the Supreme Court decision on mifepristone. which is anti-abortion groups trying to tamper with the FDA's longstanding approval of mifepristone, the first drug used in the typical medication abortion regimen. During the recent arguments in this case, it really seemed like the justices were not convinced that the anti-abortion doctors who brought this case forward had any kind of case, had any standing to bring this forward, right? They had a very tenuous connection to this issue. So it seems like just sort of on logistical grounds, that case might get, you know, might end up going our way. On the other hand, what was really frightening during the arguments was that justices like Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito seemed really into the idea that the Comstock Act from 1873, which we've talked about before, the anti-vice law, it would apply to, you know, shipping abortion pills through the mail. And of course, if that comes back into effect, it could amount to a total nationwide abortion ban. And it would, of course, impact the shipments of abortion pills from blue states into red, as well as potentially impacting the way clinics are able to operate in blue states, because you can't really run an abortion clinic without getting abortion drugs or devices through the mail at some point. So that's another one of the sort of looming questions that we have. But again, right now, today, these medication abortion options are available.
So I haven't thought about this in a while, but I remember reading or doing an interview almost a year and a half ago about this woman who wanted to put a ship off the coast of Texas, maybe, and the ship would be used to provide abortions. And everyone thought, oh, how quirky is that? Where's her ship today? I just want to let you know. I'm looking at the coastline of Florida. I'm looking at the coastline of all these places. I'm going, go into international waters. Listen, I have a yacht. I'll help you. I'll get you there. Again, we have to think outside the box. And every time I feel like it's like whack-a-mole. Every time I turn around, they're going to shut one door. I got to figure out how to open up another door. And again, the idea of being creative, the idea of shipping, the idea of protections, all these things are something that, yes, this is legal now, but they're looking to make sure it is. I mean, what the Supreme Court did with Justice Thomas, for example, was inviting another lawsuit. You know, you don't like, we don't have to worry about standing if we can talk about Comstock. You know what I mean? It's like, so you know what they're doing. The question is, how creative can we become in order to anticipate what will come next? And until we can, you know, change administrations, change a court, change the law, we need to not only prepare for what is legal now, but what may be illegal within weeks from now. And yet we need to anticipate that.
Yeah, absolutely. And Arnie, I can tell you where the ship is, right? The
okay,
ship is the internet.
You.
The ship is the internet, Arnie. That is where people are going. They are going there to connect through encrypted channels with peer-to-peer support networks. They're going there to order from clinicians like Aid Access. You know, Rebecca Gompertz, who started out Women on Waves with her ship, she's a European doctor who was sailing around, you know, providing abortions off the coast of countries like Ireland when abortion was illegal there. She is now running Aid Access, which is providing medication abortion to people in red states. So
thank you so much for that.
That's where the ship is, the proverbial, the metaphorical ship.
I love you. But one of the things I thought was absolutely fascinating was Mark Joseph Stern's piece at Slate.com. And I sent it to you last night.
Yes.
The giant threat lurking behind Florida's November abortion vote. And what he does is he dissects the court. And the court, of which I believe there are seven justices, I think, on their Supreme Court. But I know that I think six of the seven were appointed by DeSantis. So you kind
five,
of know where
five the, of the seven. But the sixth, by the way, is a lawmaker, former lawmaker who introduced anti-abortion legislation is married to the co-sponsor of the six-week abortion ban. So not exactly a neutral party there, Arnie.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for clearing that up. But he goes through and looks at their decision and how they break down. And I think it is really frightening to begin to see exactly what happens, because it isn't just about whether they're going to allow this referendum. It what could potentially happen if the referendum fails, which it needs 60% of the vote. But more importantly, even if it does pass, there is the potential for conflict between provisions within the Constitution and how this court could, in fact, put its finger on its ultimate decision making. And I think that was the other part that was so scary to me was, you know, we've known that they tend to drag their knuckles about respecting a referendum in Florida. We saw that when we tried to reinstate the franchise with ex-felons. But this, to me, is even more frightening.
Absolutely. And Arnie, you remember we talked before, you know, during the arguments in this Florida case over the abortion rights ballot initiative, Chief Justice Carlos Muniz who's one of the DeSantis appointees, started asking questions kind of out of the blue, everyone thought, about personhood and about, well, doesn't the Florida state constitution already protect the unborn because it has this phrase, natural person, that might apply to embryos? And what's fascinating about this is that at the time, even the attorneys that were arguing the anti-abortion case against the ballot measure were like, what the heck is this guy talking about, right? I mean, the attorney arguing for the state of Florida, who's trying to prevent this thing from getting on the ballot, said, I'll confess to your honor that this is not an argument I'd thought about, okay? But of course, the anti-abortion movement has been thinking about personhood for 50 years. This is or more. This has always, always, always been the goal. Personhood is the holy grail. It's just a question of how to get there. And personhood, again, when we talk about personhood, we're talking about limiting access to IVF, as we've seen in Alabama recently. We're talking about contraception, right? Because at what point does a fertilized egg become a human being, and could birth control potentially interfere with that? The Chief Justice had sort of forecast this already. Then what ended up happening is anti-abortion groups like Liberty Counsel, which was working on this case with the state of Florida, Susan B. Anthony, the Conference of Catholic Bishops, went ahead and filed a bunch of briefings saying, oh, wait a minute. We like this personhood idea. This sounds great. Oh, you guys are open to it. Fantastic. Saying that yes, this is, and they cited, you know, the court case in Alabama recently, right, where the Alabama Supreme Court, you know, notoriously established embryonic personhood, you know, affecting IVF, in vitro fertilization, and throwing the lives of people who are trying to get pregnant in that state into disarray. So we're seeing this sort of, the justices sort of teed this one up for the anti-abortion movement. And of course, they were ready because they've been thinking about this idea for a long time. And so, as Mark Joseph Stern pointed out in this excellent article, we are really seeing a preview here where six justices on this seven-person court seemed really serious about constitutionalizing fetal personhood in the state right now with the language that currently exists in the Florida Constitution. And so this is teeing up a battle, you know, if this amendment passes in Florida to enshrine abortion rights, and then you also have a Supreme Court that is heavily anti-abortion, that is going to argue that there's fetal personhood in the state constitution too, then that's teeing up, you know, a major legal battle in this state, which is pivotal to abortion access in the South, of course.
What is so interesting for Mark's article is in the dissent about not recognizing the referenda and not wanting to permit it, although they were not successful, they said the public should be made aware that the scope of the amendment could and likely would impact how personhood is defined by Florida law. The sheer breadth of the amendment, she went on, would undermine fetuses' right to enjoy and defend life under the state constitution. Yet the initiative does not identify this fact, preventing the public from fully comprehending and contemplating the changes to fetuses' fundamental liberties. This lack of candor and accuracy, she concludes, renders the proposal invalid. I mean, look at how they were able to sort of morph this referendum and use this angle as saying, well, you didn't give us the length and breadth and the extent of what this has. But what scares me about this is that it still doesn't suggest that it doesn't set it up, even if this referendum passes, that there will be this constitutional conflict as they perceive it. Then what does that mean, Amy?
You right. Know, that's the question. That's the question. And Arnie, I just want to point out, because we always talk about down ballot races here, right, that this decision was 4-3. Three of the justices were so persuaded by this fetal personhood argument, and they happened to be the three women on the court, that they would have used it to prevent Floridians from voting on this ballot initiative. Okay. And two of those women are going to be up for retention elections at the same time as this abortion rights ballot measure is on the ballot.
Oh, wow.
Justices Sasso and Francis are going to be on the same ballot as the abortion rights ballot initiative. So the people are going to have their say in more than one way in November.
Wow. And this is a statewide election, everyone. So, you know, when you hear Democrats are sort of thinking maybe there's a potential to flip Florida blue, I think there is the potential. It's not just about those two judges that you could actually overturn and turn out, because it is a statewide election for those judges. But I want to remind everyone, if you need 60% of the vote to pass this referendum, even though they may have gerrymandered the Florida State Senate, even though they may have gerrymandered the Florida State House. If you can pull 60% to pass this referendum, you could even get over the potential finger on the scale for the gerrymandered districts. Please understand this, everyone. When you gerrymander a district, you don't give them the guarantee of 90% of the vote will go for them. You're basically giving them anywhere from a 4 to 5 to 6 to 7% edge over whoever you're running against. It's that small. It's not that huge. So if you can persuade people, not only on the issue of legalizing marijuana, not only on protecting a woman's right to choose, but if you need 60% or more and you can connect the dots between what they are voting for, i.e. the referendum, and the people that you will want to support in the House and the Senate and the Supreme Court who will actually respect that decision, you could actually change the course of political history in Florida. Please understand that. Don't be threatened by gerrymandering. Show up and exercise the franchise, not just for the referendum, but for down ballot races. It is so important, Amy. People don't get that.
Absolutely, Arnie. Sense.
As we look at this and its potential, I guess I'm just trying to figure out how are we focusing this information and this knowledge on Florida. Where is it coming from? What kind of support? Whose doors are we knocking on? What kind of PSAs are they doing? What kind of damn billboards are going up? I do think in this case, the almost intimate knowledge of how bad this could be needs to be known by everyone. They need to talk about it at the McDonald's, and they need to talk about it on college campuses, because I think if they do that, that is the Velcro that will hold folks together as they go in to exercise the franchise in November. Do we know what the sort of public information assault is going to look like?
Oh, absolutely, Arnie. I mean, there's a huge grassroots campaign underway on this ballot initiative. There is a huge push because Florida has so many media markets, has a diverse Latino population, has different languages that need to be. There's a whole Spanish language outreach campaign that's going on. I mean, I've talked to the organizers there and they are certainly gearing up. And by the way, that was before the Democrats started to scratch their heads and say, maybe this Florida Supreme Court decision is going to become an opportunity for us, right? Where we're going to see President Joe, I'm not that big on abortion, Biden, trying to capitalize on Florida, which I don't know, maybe he read my piece in The Nation. But so Democrats are starting. Democrats are starting to see an opportunity there, finally. But grassroots activists had caught on to the potential for abortion rights to change the face of the state long before that.
And I need to let you go, but I want to end this way, not only by thanking Amy Littlefield, but saying ineedana.com. ineedana.com. If you have any questions about abortion access and you need to know what's happening right now and where to go, ineedana.com. Thank you, Amy Littlefield, for doing this. I truly appreciate it. This, everyone, is the Thursday edition of the Attitude with Arnie Arnison. Producer Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll show you tomorrow. Everyone, ciao. You better think-